Ladies and gentlemen, people of the internet, welcome back to yet another episode of Crypto Over Coffee. I hope you're doing well today. And if you're new here, every Saturday we break down the latest news and the hottest topics in the world of technology and cryptocurrency over a cup of delicious coffee. If you like The Office, please leave me a comment and tell me your favorite quote from the show. That being said, in today's episode, I'm talking about the crypto crash and whether we're entering a bear market, a few interesting blockchain gaming and altcoin projects, our usual 404 Logic Not Found segment, and more. So make sure that you stick around for all the updates we've got in store today on the show. Now, if you like crypto, please do subscribe to the channel, hit the bell notification button, or follow the podcast on your favorite podcast platform. Maybe that's Spotify, maybe that's Apple, who knows, but you'll get a heads up whenever I post new episodes of Crypto Over Coffee if you follow and get subscribed. Now, just a friendly reminder before we kick off with the stories, please be aware of scammers that are in the comments and all over social media that are pretending to be me and other crypto YouTubers. A lot of us don't do any outreach. We don't have WhatsApps. We're not going to ask you to contact us. So on YouTube specifically, if the comment does not have the name highlighted like you see here on the screen, you can go ahead and report them because they are not me. So please be safe out there, folks. By the way, every week I give away a Keystone tablet steel seed phrase backup device by picking a random YouTube commenter from the video. And all you have to do to enter the random draw is leave any comment on this video. That's right, any comment on the YouTube video and you're entered. So the winner of last week's giveaway by random draw is here on the screen. Congratulations, I will be in touch. All right, let's address the elephant in the room first, the headline of the show, which is this crypto crash and whether it indicates a bear market for crypto or not. Now, as you probably know already, over the last 24 hours, we've experienced a significant and undoubtedly disconcerting market-wide crash in the cryptocurrency space. This crash saw Bitcoin, for example, crash from its recent support of 54,000 down all the way to the low 40Ks in a very short time scale, with the lowest reported price, by the way, being 41,000 in some markets, although I'm not sure how real that actually was. Similarly, though, altcoins were largely crushed under this weight as well, and Ether took a hit below 4K in the panic along the way. All in all, not a good day and night for crypto and crypto investors. And as you sit here right now listening to Crypto Over Coffee, you're probably wondering if this means that the bear market is upon us. Did we just get that double top? And are we all just doomed to another several year long bear market? Now let's discuss this a little bit further. First of all, I want to empathize with everyone out there who might be feeling overwhelmed by this. Whether you're a long-term holdler or you're just buying in recently, I know this is tough to swallow when the markets are going bad. The best thing to do now is to take emotion out of the equation and think objectively about where we're at right now and what the path forward might be. We've had a big price retraction in a short period of time. Yes, that's true. But we've not broken into extreme bear territory quite yet. If Bitcoin largely succumbed to the $40,000 support, I would have been singing a much different tune here. However, at the time of recording, Bitcoin is already hitting a retest of 50,000 and Ether is back above 4,000. It's not a recovery per se, but it's a start. It's a show that there's some strength there. For a while now, I've been given my hypothesis that we would still see new price discovery for many cryptocurrencies at the end of this year in 2021. And while that's still technically possible, I've now realized that my original prediction is probabilistically less likely now. That said, I do still believe that we have not yet entered a full-scale bear market. These signals just don't seem to be there for me right now. There isn't a grand consensus that we're going up again. Markets are not confident like they were in previous end of bull run periods where everyone thought we were going up and we were going down. There are negative macro events going on in the world that are pushing markets down, and that's a big part of this. You also have the prevalence of countries, institutions, and other sophisticated entities that don't seem to be done buying in, that kind of points away from a bear market. This is a much different rodeo than in 2017, 2018, for many reasons. And I do believe that in 2022, there is still room left for another run up. What I'm not saying is that I promise or that I know for a fact or that I can guarantee this. I'm simply giving you my intuition or my data-driven hypothesis based on my experience in these markets. And I think that's part of the problem here. Lots of people go on social media like YouTube and Twitter and see all these big price predictions and timelines, and they begin to think that It's a surefire thing that it's gonna happen. But you have to realize that no one knows what the markets are gonna do. I'm wrong all the time, and so is everyone else. Any prediction about the markets is about as precise as a fast-talking auctioneer announcer counting seconds with the Mississippi technique. It just doesn't work. The only guarantee in crypto is that you don't know what's gonna happen, right? The only guarantee is that there are no guarantees. So plan accordingly. If you're looking at crypto as a long-term play and you've got coins that you wanted to buy, but you didn't like at the prices we had before the crash, maybe now is time to implement the strategy I outlined in last week's Crypto Over Coffee for altcoin investing during a dip. So I'll leave that linked up here and just in case you want to check that episode out. However, you might be feeling like you're stuck in a loss position, having bought recently and now we've made our way down. And my advice to you is this: if you're in this position, think about it this way. Do you believe that whatever coin you invested in provides value and solves a problem long term? If the answer to that question is yes, then ask yourself if you can live without the money you invested in this and let it be a long-term investment. If the answer is no, you invested too much in the beginning and you need to learn from that and not repeat that mistake. Everyone does this once in a while, so don't feel badly. But if the answer to that question is yes, you can live without that money, then you should take the emotion out of this and make a decision about whether you want to let this one ride for a while and not panic sell, or you want to cut your losses and take the capital loss for taxes. I believe wholeheartedly that crypto is a part of our future, and the ancillary technologies it brings will be ubiquitous in our society in the long term. Whether we get a bull market resurgence in 2022 or a multi-year bear market, I'm gonna be right here in this chair making videos and investing in what I believe in. I'll take profits along the way. I'll take care of my family. I'll stick to a plan and a risk management strategy like I talk about all the time on this show. This is my philosophy. I believe that we're not entering a bear market, but the best way to kick the anxiety about whether or not we are is to plan and prepare like we are entering a bear market. Worst case, you're ready for the winter. Best case, you're pleasantly surprised when we rip back up to new all-time highs. So please be safe and feel free to message me anytime if you need help, you want some advice, you just want to talk. I know this space can be stressful, so it always helps to have resources. So I'd love to help you if I can. Now, I want to kick the somber mood here and talk about a project that I think is really cool in the Polkadot ecosystem. So cool, in fact, that I did invest in their project early with a very modest sum. Just for transparency's sake, you should know that. I'm not asking you to invest in it, so I'm not pumping my bags. I actually don't even have access to tokens yet, okay? That being said, the project is called Zeitgeist, and they're building a powerful prediction markets platform that will allow users to create tradable markets around queries like, what will the price of DOT be on this date according to this marketplace? Or which horse will win the D-Race virtual horse race game today? Those who buy market shares for the correct answer, sort of this economic lever, they'll be reported by an Oracle construct, basically what happens, and then they'll be able to exchange those shares for the correct answer for the native ZTG token, while those who purchase shares of the market for any incorrect answer will not receive anything. So you're basically putting an economic bet, if you will, on the outcome of something happening. So I love making data-driven guesses and answers for stuff, so this is right up my alley. It's like guessing the number of jelly beans in the jar. Anyway, Zeitgeist just announced their plan for their Kusama crowd loan, which will hopefully land them a future slot as a parachain in the Kusama network, which is the canary network for Polkadot. Much like the crowd loans we've talked about in previous shows, there are rewards on offer for those who contribute KSM to Zeitgeist to help them bond a parachain slot or lease a parachain slot on Kusama, including early bird bonus ZTG rewards for those who support the project early. My highly intelligent audience, and that's you, by the way, is probably thinking, okay, great, but what's the risk? And that's a great question. If you contribute your KSM, the native token in Kusama, to the Zeitgeist crowd loan and they win a slot before January 9th, 2022, it will be locked up for 48 weeks, up to 48 weeks in bond. However, if Zeitgeist is unable to win a slot, your KSM is returned to you at that January 9th deadline. The risk here is purely in your ability to liquidate KSM. While it's locked, you're exposed to the price fluctuations of KSM because you can't sell it. So I would encourage you to dig deeper into Zeitgeist, see what you think, and I'll leave a link below for more info. Leave me a comment, tell me what you think. And next up, I want to talk about a pretty cool blockchain game that I've been watching for a little while now, and we're starting to get to some of the exciting stuff, so now's a good time to talk about it. As you might know from other videos, I am an avid avid football fan. And when I say football, I mean the proper term for soccer. So if you say soccer, fine and dandy. I love casual football games, soccer games, whatever. It's one of my favorite casual gaming pastimes when I'm waiting in line for something or I have time to kill. In light of this, the game Monkey Ball came across my radar a while back, and it immediately piqued my interest because of that topic, that soccer football topic. Of course, things like stadiums and the monkeys who are the actual players on the field will be for sale soon as NFTs, and the game will feature play-to-earn mechanics as well as other things that other games are doing these days, right? The usual, the NFTs, the blockchain-based game, play-to-earn. What's cool about this, though, is it captures some of the more immersive elements of other football games, such as training tasks to level up your monkey's skills in the game before matches, and attribute-based team building across different positions on the field. In addition, the rewards from each match are split between the winner of the match, the owner of the NFT stadium where the match was played, and the spectators who supported the winning team. Now, this mechanic is pretty cool because it rewards multiple types of users in the game, the player, the stadium NFT owner, and even casual supporters. I mean, how cool would it be to passively earn even a small amount of money for owning a stadium NFT where matches are played? Now, I haven't invested in this project personally, but I'm definitely exploring the idea of the upcoming NFT sales and investing there because I want to play matches and own a stadium personally. And by the way, for transparency, I did invest early in one of the launch pads that Monkey Ball is launching on, Star Launch. That said, I'm not making this segment to tell you to go buy into any token or project, but rather to point out an early stage game that I think has potential. I think it would be really cool even to be a supporter and cheer on your favorite team and potentially get rewards that could help you then build a team down the line. So definitely dig into this more and see what you think. Now, next up is a really, really important topic that I think every single crypto investor needs to know, particularly if you use Ethereum or other smart contract-enabled blockchains. As you know, hackers are everywhere trying to steal your crypto and your money and your data, and they've come up with creative ways to do it, and we know this. Lately, one method is really, really successful, even against crypto veterans who know not to expose their seed phrase or their private key, not to use a phishing site, whatever. The hacking technique goes like this. The hacker either maliciously modifies the user interface for a dApp or publishes a fake copy of that interface and lists it on Google in the first spot. Then the hacker doesn't ask for one's private key or seed phrase or other things that would throw up red flags for a veteran. Instead, the hacker uses the user's habitual behavior to their advantage. When you or I, a user, goes to a dApp website, we want to transact. So we naturally want to sign a transaction on MetaMask or some other wallet in the process. And we do this all the time. So the hacker uses that behavior as a means to steal your funds. Instead of providing a valid transaction to do some prescribed action on the dApp, some legit action, the hacker provides a transaction that leverages the approval functionality native to token contracts to give the hacker's own smart contract approval to move your funds with ERC-20 tokens, right? This functionality is what lets DeFi protocols manage your funds, for example. Similar to terms and conditions, though, very few people check their transaction contents before signing. And once that transaction is signed, the hacker can now steal your funds for the coin that you approved. Because you're signing a transaction in a legitimate way, a hardware wallet alone is not going to protect you from this either. If you sign with your hardware wallet, you also are going to get hit with this. So there are a few ways to protect yourself here. Before you sign any transaction, always drop down the View Full Transaction Details dropdown on MetaMask, for example, especially when giving approval permissions for a contract to access your funds for a given coin. In there, you can see the approval amount and how much you're approving to be used, right? The contract that you're letting manage those funds and other information about this, right? So you want to make sure the approval amount makes sense. Never give unlimited approval, okay? This doesn't make sense most of the time. And then you can go check that contract address on Etherscan or other explorers and make sure it matches with the contracts listed for the dApp you're using and look for red flags like the contract was just deployed recently, things like that. Moral of the story, when you're approving funds from a UI, always check the transaction before signing. It's the same as double checking your address. It's key to being safe. And please, please be safe out there, folks. Now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for 404 Logic Not Found, and for those of you who are as of yet uninitiated in this little firecracker of a segment, most of you are, I highlight notable tech-related fails or otherwise stupid moves in the world that need to get some attention. Speaking of attention, you know the drill. If you want to help this episode of Crypto Over Coffee get some attention from the algorithm robots, please hit the like button, get subscribed, follow the podcast, whatever you can do to tell those robots that you're enjoying the content that you're watching and that others might also enjoy it so those robots can share it with them. So thank you for that in advance. Now, this week's Absence of Logic is squarely focused on the wireless tech giant Qualcomm, who recently announced what I think could compete for the most privacy-ignorant product launch in the recent past. That's my opinion, of course, but let me explain why I have that opinion. Qualcomm announced their latest Snapdragon 8 Generation 1 processor, largely for Android smartphones. And one feature that they touted as some kind of enhancement is the introduction of the always-on camera, which is consistently and constantly looking for the device owner's face to determine the locked status of the smartphone, among other things. This feature is being touted as a boon for inconvenient unlock and lock mechanics on smartphones, for example, which require you to pick up the device and interact with it to unlock it, where this always-on camera instead can just determine when the device owner is present and lock the phone when they are not. However, this is baffling to me for a multitude of reasons. First of all, I don't really believe that people have such a big problem with their phone not unlocking until they interact with it, because when I want to use my phone, I interact with it, I pick it up, or I at least touch the screen, so it really doesn't matter to me. Second, there's been this history of webcam and microphone abuse by hackers and just general apps in the past, right? Which has driven OEMs to add indicators to their software to show when the mic and camera are being used by a specific application. So why would anyone on earth think that having a hardware level always on camera is a good idea? Why? I mean, yes, phone makers like Samsung could decide just not to implement this hardware with the feature, but they could, and I don't like the idea that they could do that. They would need to then add an indicator to show you from a hardware level that the camera's on. It's not worth it. To me, the debatable convenience benefits are massively outweighed by the potential for abuse of this feature, both by nefarious actors and the largely privacy-violating user-tailored content industry that uses your data to tailor ads and content to you. Everything about this hardware screams privacy nightmare to me, and I don't know what market research was done here to indicate that the reaction would be anything but trepidatious from the tech community on this one. It's such a clear 404 logic not found to me. Such a clear one. I simply don't have the level of trust in phone makers and software developers and just in general, like wireless carriers, to have a device wired for an always-on camera. And I know that smartphones in general are privacy violating by nature in many ways, and I'm not absolving other hardware makers for their part in this whole mess, but this particular instance seems like a step in the wrong direction for Android phones in particular. But you let me know in the comments. If I'm way off, tweet me, leave a comment on YouTube, whatever you want. All right, folks, it is sponsor time, which helps keep coffee in my mug and this show coming to you every week across all platforms. Literally this time, actually, because the last episode, you remember, my camera broke while I was traveling. That trip was pretty rough, and I had to buy a new one when I got back just to make videos. Ouch. Anyways, big thank you to my friends at Unstoppable Domains, who sponsored some segments on the show to finish out the year in 2021. After announcing the features in November, the shift in November, Unstoppable Domains has officially launched on Polygon, which now means that you can mint and manage your NFT blockchain-based domain names completely for free on the Unstoppable Domains platform and on their interface. So they're going to cover all the fees for you now that they are more affordable. Ethereum, the fees suck. We know this. In addition, NFT profile picture fans can now link their Bored Ape, their Cool Cat, their Pudgy Penguin, etc., with their Unstoppable Domain to prove ownership of said NFT and personalize it with their own custom domain, like Hashoshi4.com. crypto, for example. I tip my hat to Unstoppable for making their service more accessible for a wider audience with this move to free management and for doubling down on cool features like NFT verification. I do also want to thank Yay Games for sponsoring this episode of Crypto Over Coffee. Yay Games is a gaming marketplace project which is supporting the launch of gaming projects in the Avalanche ecosystem and beyond, and it was recently added to the Ava Labs Avalanche Rush program. One of Yay Games' core products is their launchpad platform dubbed Zeus, which is a hub for up-and-coming blockchain gaming projects to facilitate IGOs, or initial game offerings. Now, one key differentiating factor for Zeus as a platform is that instead of offering public sales to its users, it's really focusing on offering opportunities in early and private round sales to users of the platform, giving more people access to earlier investment opportunities that are often few and far between. Access to allocations on the Zeus platform is doled out based on a tiered staking mechanism, where users with more skin in the game are given more significant allocation opportunities. For example, let's take a funding round for a project in IGO that has 400,000 worth of tokens up for grabs. That might be split up as follows. Those who stake and lock up the native Yay Games token for 14 days have varying degrees of probability to win an allocation. The top 100 stakers by volume of that group have a randomized chance of landing an allocation of higher value, like $750 or $500 or all the way down to like $250 worth, for example. Then the remaining stakers, so outside of that top 100, they're randomly drawn for the remaining slots for allocation, which is determined by the funds that are remaining available and the allocation size. For example, there might be 450 slots up for grabs at $125 a piece in allocation. So this randomized draw then picks the winners for those remaining allocation slots, who can then complete their allocation purchase. Now, this is for those shorter lockup times, that 14-day lockup. But those who really believe in the Yay Games platform long-term can lock up their stake for 2 years, a really long time, like that's a light year in crypto, and get airdropped allocations for certain projects, which is pretty significant. So it's an airdrop, not a buy. Now, this is just an example, and the tiers will likely vary between projects that launch on the Zeus platform, and one of those upcoming projects or games that's launching on Zeus using this tiered allocation framework is in fact a Yay Games title called Bold Point, which is a turn-based player versus player card game with a medieval theme. You know I like medieval theme stuff. So stay tuned for more information about Bold Point. In addition to the Zeus platform, Yay Games also offers a series of mini games, a web interface to find other cool third-party games, and a single view dashboard for IGO participants to view their vesting information. Now, I do want to mention, please note, access to this and all Launchpad platforms in the whole of crypto world is governed by jurisdictional laws and regulations. So access to the platform is dependent on those factors, which you need to be aware of. Furthermore, investment in any project or cryptocurrency, as always, exposes you to significant risks. So please understand those risks before deciding to enter into a speculative investment, particularly early on. This video is not a call to action to invest in any token or asset of any kind, which you should be used to by now, because that's always the story. Okay, let's do some community Q&A now. I always answer questions from folks who watch the show, and I've got some questions from last week's episode that I'm going to answer, and I want to remind you that if you have a question that you want answered, leave them in the comments down below on YouTube, or you can tweet me at Hishoshi4 as well if you are on a podcast platform and don't have the YouTube comments. So let's dive into these questions. All right, first question of the day is from Alex W. Speaking of the multi-chain future, would love to hear your thoughts on all the bridge projects, i.e. Relay Chain, etc. Okay, so here's the deal. Bridges are important. Bridges are not going to go away. A bridge basically is a code-based mechanism to lock funds on an origin chain and then mint those funds on a destination chain. So you basically have vaults, contract vaults, smart contract vaults on both blockchains on either end of a spectrum. So there's no actual real bridge. What you're really doing is you have these two sort of atomic connected smart contract vaults that react to one another. Now that we have that out of the way, the basic concept is, let's say you have a bridge that bridges funds from, let's do an easy one, bridges funds from Ethereum to Polygon, right? What happens is you deposit Ether, for example, or you deposit your ERC20 MATIC tokens into a smart contract on the Ethereum mainnet. It's your origin chain, okay? Once those funds are locked up, the atomic element of this is that what happens on one side sort of is needs to be reacted to on the other and balance out. The same number of tokens on the other end on Polygon then get minted as a sort of a synthetic asset, or you retrieve or receive native MATIC, for example, or wrapped Ether, right? So that's basically what a bridge is. It's a way to lock assets on the origin chain and receive assets, synthetic or otherwise, on the destination chain. Keeping those vaults in balance and making sure every transaction is atomic. When you lock up on one side, you need to create or receive on the other side, and then vice versa. When you lock up and burn on one side, you need to release on the other side. And there's various different ways to do that. The problem is that bridges are often a target for hacks because funds get locked up in these vaults. So this is a place where hackers really want to go after, and they will find issues in a contract if there are any. And we have plenty of examples of this happening in the past, particularly, and I forget, I don't want to call it the wrong thing. It's not Polymarket, it's Poly something that was on the Polygon ecosystem. And there was that massive, massive bridge hack. That's not going to go away, right? Bridge hacks are the new big thing. That's a honeypot for hackers, okay? So I like bridges because they let people move funds from, for example, people on Ethereum can't access DeFi because it's too darn expensive to use. The fact that they can move to Polygon or move those funds to Phantom or Avalanche is really good, but there's always risk in using bridges. So my thing is, bridges are great. Relay Chain, AnySwap, all these different bridges, like Near has some cool bridges. There's tons of really cool ones out there, but you have to be very careful and know the risks, okay? Very important, native interoperability plus bridges is going to be the future, but those bridges are going to be subject to significant scrutiny and are gonna need significant, deep, deep audits, okay? That's my thought. Thank you for your question. Next question is Mohammed. Can you cover and explain whatever Wonderland time is all about? I can't wrap my head around the ridiculously high APY. How is that possible? Where is the money coming from? I don't know anything about Wonderland time. I will look it up, but I figured I would answer this question anyway because I can tell you where a lot of these ridiculously high APYs come from. A lot of this is kind of it's augmented, let's put it that way. So sometimes when a platform first launches, they have sort of a treasury set up that helps pay for and subsidize these high APYs. And that's to drive users to use the platform. And then as users use the platform, their usage and the taxes or the fees that they pay to use the new platform, particularly in DeFi or some game or whatever, that funds the treasury. So then you kind of use funds originally to build up the treasury that you might have raised in an early round, right? You might have raised from private and venture capital, whatever. You use those funds in the token form to pay and subsidize the APY to bring in new users. Those new users use the platform, they start feeding that treasury. If you get enough users, you can start to pay for the operation of the protocol without subsidizing it anymore. Now, this is something that not everyone is very stoked about because some people are like, oh, well, it's not really realistic. The APYs are not sustainable. And in many cases, they aren't. There are some, though, that are smart in the way that they do it, in making it beneficial to early adopters and then subsequently kind of backing it off over time on a protocol-based way, not in a centralized way where we're just gonna slash it arbitrarily, but in a protocol-based way based on usage or time delay or whatever that might be. So generally, you see these high APYs derivative of subsidizing based off of funds that were raised or subsidizing based off of over time that treasury or staking rewards being funded by usage of a platform. That's where the APY comes from, okay? Now, not all projects that have these high APYs are going to be able to sustain them for a long period of time. And I think most legitimate projects kind of level out at a reasonable APY. But what's reasonable to you is different. It's subjective. So just please exercise caution. I know I sound like a broken record, but I always exercise caution. I don't go FOMO in really hard on a project that I haven't had adequate time to look into. I'd be happy to miss out on earlier, higher APYs to make sure that I'm not putting funds at risk. That's my philosophy. Not telling you what to do, but that's my thought. Okay? Thank you, Mohammed. Next question, Adnan Hussein. I heard Unstoppable Domains are Web3. It works like a wallet. You don't have to share long addresses, just your domain name. If I get a .NFT domain name from Unstoppable, will it work as a wallet for all cryptos or just specific related to NFTs? So this is what I want to share with you. Unstoppable Domains is not a wallet. Unstoppable Domains is a resolver, meaning just like a website, right? Behind the scenes, the web uses IP addresses. Ugly IP addresses. It's numbers and periods or even alphanumeric if you're talking about IPv6, okay? So you've got these really ugly things that no one will remember. I don't remember to go to youtube.com with 172.69.540.069. And I know that's totally arbitrary. It's not even a correct implementation of an IPv4 address, okay? I'm just using it prescriptively. That number, no one will remember. So what they, back in the day, what was done is you create DNS, which is domain names that allow you to remember a human readable name like youtube.com, which through a resolver resolves to the IP address. So the ugly computery numbery alphanumeric thing that no one would remember. So it's a way for people to easily remember something. Crypto addresses are the same. They're really ugly alphanumeric long things that no one, well, I'm not gonna say no one, very few people could ever memorize. There are some crazy photographic memory people out there, but very few people can memorize crypto addresses. And so this way, you can use your domain, your, you know, adnan.nft to map your human readable name, adnan.nft, to different crypto addresses. So Unstoppable Domains is not creating wallets for you. They're taking public keys or addresses for wallets you already have, for Ethereum, for Bitcoin, for Cardano, whatever it is, and you kind of write those in. They get written to a record on the blockchain related to your domain, and then when someone calls on a wallet, for example, they type in adnan.nft on a wallet that supports Unstoppable Domains resolution, it will resolve that cryptocurrency ticker symbol plus adnan.nft to the address that you stored with your NFT domain name, okay? So that's really what it is. They're not creating a wallet for you. They're just resolving your human readable name to a crypto address. Does that make sense? I know you can't answer me. It hopefully makes sense. If it doesn't make sense though, leave me an additional comment. I'd be happy to clarify further. Thank you for your question. Last question here of the day is from Bad Carol. Privacy related question, love these. If I'm using a multi-chain wallet, are the addresses from, or are the addresses on the different chains publicly connected? Can one tell which ETH address and which Icon address belong to the same wallet? Now, this is an interesting question. So in a wallet where you're sort of aggregating multiple different cryptocurrency wallets from a single seed, realistically, unless the address is derived the same way. So like, for example, you know how you can use your Ethereum address across all these Ethereum compatible chains like Avalanche or Polygon or whatever, then yes, because it's the exact same address. But if I derive from the same seed, and the way that this works mechanically is a little wonky, right? There's a reason why a lot of wallets don't work this way. Let's say I derive from the same seed, which not the best idea, but from the same seed, a Bitcoin key and address combo and an Ethereum key and address combo. There's very little ways for me to map those two together because they're derived differently, right? It's really hard, if not impossible, to map those together, except for based on activity. So let's just say you have a doxed address on Ethereum, right? So you have a doxed address on Ethereum and you have an NFT wallet and you're sending NFTs and the people can track that and they know where you send things from that wallet. And let's say you have an exchange account where you're not rotating addresses. Don't do this. Then you send maybe, for some reason, you're sending another cryptocurrency to that same exchange and then you're moving funds around. You convert that cryptocurrency to Ether, for example, and then that you send back to this other wallet. So you've kind of made this loop where you've converted. Someone really savvy could maybe make the connection that this address on a different chain is linked to you, but we're talking a really like out there, really extra process to do that. I think right now the real concern would be if you have a multi-chain wallet, even like MetaMask, where you use the same address on multiple chains, people being able to track you across those different chains. Privacy-wise, you should be rotating addresses. You shouldn't be doxing wallets that you trade and you hold from. You should have a public wallet where you maybe keep things that you don't mind people knowing about and don't send things from that public wallet to one of your private wallets, because then everyone can figure it out, okay? So there's the thought. It's not impossible to track. It's a little more difficult to track. With a couple little tweaks in terms of your OPSEC and how you approach it, I think you would just generally be pretty fine, okay? So thank you very much, Bad Carol, for your question. That is indeed the last question of the day. Thank you so much for being patient with me today. I'm learning a new camera setup and everything. Hopefully everything looked pretty good, pretty nice. I'll be refining this over the next several weeks. But most of all, thank you so much for watching or listening to Crypto Over Coffee. If you have the time to stick around, you can check out last week's episode or another one of the videos or podcast episodes that'll be linked up. I want to wish you and your family a wonderful week and weekend ahead. And until next time, cheers.